Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The fall migration is well underway, and birders of all stripes have set out to watch the change, the ebb and flow of this ancient pattern. More than 700 avid birdwatchers from across the country will converge on Northern Ohio for a birding festival at the end of the week. But birds are everywhere, and there's always plenty to talk about on that score with famed naturalist Ken Kaufman. Ken followed the path of the ornithologist when he was just 16 years old, traveling 80,000 miles at the time to break the record for sighting the most species. But he doesn't scorn those among us who relegate our viewing to the park down the street. He's written many, many books. The latest is a memoir, Flights Against the Sunset. Welcome, Ken.
Good morning, Ann.
One of the things I like about your approach to nature is its accessibility. On your website, you note that you turned to wild birds because tigers and elephants weren't likely to appear in your backyard in Indiana.
That's right. I mean, I looked very carefully, and we just didn't have those things. So when I didn't really give up and just settle on birds until I was about six. But after that, I tried to make up for lost time.
The ripe old age of six.
That's right.
When did it occur to you consciously that, hey, I'm a birder?
I didn't really think about the term or anything. I mean, I knew I was obsessed with birds and other things in nature, but the birds were the most, you know, they were the easiest things to find. And when I was 7, 8, 9 years old, I was reading everything I could find. It wasn't until I was 10 or 11 that I decided that I wanted to grow up and write bird books.
Okay, so you knew what your life's course was back then.
And I had a pretty good idea of what I wanted to do.
But you've done a lot of other things, too. You don't limit yourself to just birds. You see them in the context of the entire ecosystem and all of nature. How does that work for you? When did that kind of – did you switch to that gear or add that gear to your repertoire?
That probably came about when I was about 12 or 13. Up to that point, I figured I'd better not spend any time looking at, you know, bugs or – reptiles or anything like that, because it would take away from my bird watching time. But you know, when you're out there, you just can't help running across things that look interesting. You know, just really strikingly patterned butterflies and turtles, and especially if you're a little boy, you know, I couldn't resist, you know, catching snakes and chasing bugs around.
Right, the tadpole phase with
That's
egg jars,
right.
And you went through all that, didn't you, with the rest of us? What? Tell me about your backyard that you grew up in, because it. You know, I want to say it sounds amazing, even without the lions and tigers, but.
Well, actually, it was just a very average suburban backyard in South Bend, Indiana. I mean, we were in town. There wasn't any real open country or natural habitat anywhere nearby. So I didn't really have access to anything that looked like wilderness. We moved to Kansas then when I was 9, and again, it was just suburbs, and there were hardly any trees because it was a new sort of development. But on my bicycle, I could get out to areas with some marshes and open fields.
What was the first bird that caught your eye?
Well, you'll laugh if I tell you. I'd been trying to find the big spectacular animals, and when I concluded that they wouldn't be around, I thought, well, I'll just take a day or two and figure out what these birds are. This was while we were still in Indiana, of course. And so there are these blackbirds wandering around on the lawn, and I didn't have any bird books, so it required looking at them and then, you know, doing little sketches and then going to the library. And so the first birds that I actually figured out the names of were the common grackle and the starling.
Well, didn't you just love those words, though, when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, my family and I were looking through one of your books last night, and my husband couldn't help but say, oh, the yellow-bellied sapsucker.
That's right.
I mean, it just automatically, you know, kids love that. That's what we called each other when we were kids, at least, and when we were chickens, which is another bird. You've started when you were very, very young. How old are you now, if you don't mind my asking?
No,
I couldn't find that anywhere.
Yeah, I try to keep that carefully hidden, but I'm 55, but I don't act like it.
Okay. Well, my world and welcome to it. So you were 16 in the 70s when you took off to discover as many species as you could over the course of 80,000 miles, was it?
That's right. I was hitchhiking around the country actually for about 5 years, but the year that I turned 19, I went all out and just tried to see how many birds I could find in just one calendar year.
And how many was that?
Under the classification that applied at the time, it was 671 species.
And what does that mean under the classification at the time?
Well, things get lumped and split. There are always these changes going on. There's a bird that migrates through Ohio in small numbers that's now called Nelson's sparrow, but as recently as 20 years ago, it was part of a species called sharp-tailed sparrow, but it's been split up.
Sounds like the stock market.
That's right, yeah.
But not as moneyed, or maybe not as I guess one of the questions I had was about how things have changed over the years. There's the human classifications of things, and then there's the actual natural world. And since you've looked at it and studied it so closely from that point of view, how has it changed the most?
Well, there are changes going on all the time, and it's actually not like the stock market, because you can't just put a number on, you know, how nature is doing, because anytime there's one kind of bird that's decreasing in numbers, there will be others that are increasing and actually doing better. So some kinds of birds, like some of the forest birds and grassland birds, their numbers have dropped, but at the same time, we've seen increases in numbers of things like bald eagles, for example. And so some birds are doing quite well.
Why are the forest birds and the grass, you said grassland birds?
Yeah.
Why are those dropping?
Well, that's a good question. In some cases, there's actually more forest, more total acres of forest in parts of the U.S. now than there were 20 or 30 years ago. And so the fact that some of the forest birds are still declining, we don't know for sure. It may be that they're losing habitat on their wintering grounds. These are birds that will migrate to Central America or South America for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Grasslands in general, native grasslands that are high quality, have really declined in total acreage.
And why are grasslands important? We usually don't associate birds with nesting in grasslands or anything like that. Why is that?
Well, that's right. Well, most kinds don't, but there are birds that are specialized for that habitat and really can't do without it. I mean, one example would be something called the bobolink, which is it's fairly common in summer in some parts of Ohio. There are a lot of them over in Amish country, and in fact, they've got a local bird newsletter over there called the bobolink.
Another great word.
Yeah, it's a great publication, too. There are a lot of real expert Amish birders. But this bobolink, the male is black and yellow and white, beautifully patterned. It flies around over the grass doing this bubbling song that, if you have a good imagination, you could say, oh, it's singing, you know, the name bobolink over and over. I mean, it helps to have a good imagination for all this. But these birds, they migrate to southern South America for the winter, and they winter in grasslands down there. And it's, you know, you'll never find bobolinks nesting in a forest or a marsh or on a sandy beach. They just need these meadows. They will nest in hay fields, but if the hay fields are harvested on sort of a typical schedule, the nests, they don't actually complete the nesting cycle.
How well are birds able to adapt to their migratory patterns to the changing landscape below? As we, you know, take away fields and add fields, some places are trying to naturalize their parks now. I know they are in parts of a big Worthington park along the Olentangy River to attract more birds and other kinds of animals. How well can birds adapt to the pros and the cons of our landscape?
Well, some birds are very adaptable, and, you know, it's very encouraging to see that if you create new habitat, some of these birds will just move in immediately. And so, in general, the birds that are more adaptable and more able to move around are the ones that are doing well. And those that are really specialized tend to not do as well, because specialized habitats often, you know, disappear and they're harder to replace.
And so they're looking for that same pond in that same place every year. And if it goes away.
Yeah. And that's something that we're concerned about. There aren't too many birds really that are in that category, but cerulean warbler would be one example. It's a beautiful little bird. It's very small, bright blue on the back and patterned with white and black. And it nests in good numbers in southern Ohio, but it needs good quality forest. And if the forests are fragmented or cut up into smaller pieces, they don't do so well.
Why is it important to constantly monitor the comings and goings of birds and their migrations and the numbers of birds and how do you really actually keep track of that when you have so many different people doing it?
Well,
I guess that's two questions. I guess, first of all, why is it so important?
Well, we feel like it's good to have sort of an early warning of what's going on. I mean, in the past there were some birds that disappeared before anyone was really paying attention. Little bird called the Backman's Warbler that used to be found in the southeastern U.S. It's probably extinct now, and nobody even knows why. We don't know enough about it to know why it disappeared. So part of the emphasis now is just keeping track of birds while they're still common. And if something, I mean, we know the numbers of populations are going up and down all the time for different birds. But if something goes into a long-term decline, we want to know that and try to figure out why.
They can go up and down because for a lot of reasons it would occur regardless of anything humans do. The weather, that kind of a thing. Sometimes they get stuck places and you get a cold snap, that kind of a thing.
That's right. I mean, if there's a very wet summer, it's going to favor some birds and it's going to be bad for others, for example.
It might sound elementary, but what's important about biodiversity to birds? Because you talk about that on your website, and you know, where does the biodiversity come into it?
Well, but part of the idea is that a really diverse system is going to be more stable and more healthy. And when you have you go into a forest, there's really a lot going on there. You have all these different kinds of plants and, you know, thousands of different kinds of insects living there, and all the birds and the little amphibians down in the leaf litter. So there are thousands of species of things living in this forest, and each of them has its own sort of part that it plays. And, you know, one thing eating another or supporting the germination of the seeds of something else. And you know, it may be a small part, but they all add to it. So it's like, a friend of mine uses the analogy of having a building, a wooden building put together with thousands of nails holding it in place. And as you start popping the nails out, the building becomes less stable.
I suppose you talked about when something disappears, you start to try to figure out why, because that tells you something about something else that might be going wrong down the line.
That's right. Yeah, this analogy has been used way too often. It's become a cliche, but the whole idea of the canaries in the coal mine.
Yeah.
You know, miners taking canaries down there, and if the canary croaks, we figure there's something bad going on, and we should pay attention.
You have been paying attention, I hope, to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you would like to join the conversation with famed birder Ken Kaufman, call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.
WOSU News reports on the stories you need to hear and the stories you want to hear.
Rivka was a Muslim, but now she says she's a Christian, an act Rivka says is unforgivable by the Islam faith and her family.
They're pinning this not just on the family, but saying, you know, that this is what Islam teaches. No, that couldn't be farther from the truth.
Get more from your news with the award-winning WOSU News Team on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and classical music.
Good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Emma Fett in for Amy Jurevich this week. Currently, it's 71 degrees and fair, a mix of sun and clouds today, high expected around 83 degrees.
Support for WOSU comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency Incorporated, serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses for 154 years, 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Ken Kaufman. He's a legend among birders, the youngest person ever to receive the Ludlow Griscom Award, the highest honor of the American Birding Association. He's the author of many books, including his latest, a memoir, Flights Against the Sunset, Stories That Reunited a Mother and Son. Ken, tell me about that book.
Well, thanks for asking. That just came out last year, and it's most of it, probably two-thirds of the book, is a collection of essays that I'd written over the last 20 years or so, most of which appeared in Birdwatcher's Digest, which is actually published here in Ohio. But these essays had started off, well, I've written dozens of things for Birdwatcher's Digest, but these were essays that were in particular about sort of interactions between birds and humans. And I put these essays together, wove them together with a story about going back to Kansas and trying to explain, you know, finally to my mother why it was I took off at the age of 16 to go running around chasing birds.
That's what I thought, because as a mother, I would think I would love to be the fly on the wall on that conversation. How did you do that?
Well, that's what the book does, partly, is to just sort of tell a series of stories rather than, I mean, you know, I could, if I just try to talk about birds and say, oh, you know, well, this particular kind of flycatcher is very interesting because of this, you know, it doesn't translate well for those who are not interested in birds already. So this is just stories about experiences, traveling different places and leading groups of bird watchers in different places.
Tell me one of those stories.
Okay, well, one story had to do with being in South America, and we were looking for a bird called the plain-backed ant pitta, which is a terrible name.
No, it's great.
It's this bird that's almost impossible to see. It goes sort of bouncing around on the forest floor back in the deep jungle, and it does this soft sort of ghostly call, like, and you hear it and you follow it for hours and you never see it. And we were behind this old biological station in a national park in Venezuela. And this biological station is this huge building that was originally built as sort of a castle by the last dictator of Venezuela just before he was deposed. And so it's this really strange setting, but we're in the forest there trying to find this bird. And one of the guys peels off and goes and finds that this ant pitta is actually calling from inside the building behind us, which is why we can't find it.
And how would that move your mother?
it helped.
I'm not moved as a mother. I think it's interesting.
Well, okay.
I guess the idea was it was the culmination of these stories brought together to kind of sort of explain to her what why you cared so much about these things that you would leave her at such a young age.
Yeah, I mean, when I just try to recount one of the stories like that in a brief way,
it doesn't.
It may not.
How did she like the book?
May not translate well.
How did your mother like the book?
Well, she actually passed away before the book was published.
I'm sorry.
So she didn't have a chance to see it, but I know that she appreciated some of the stories at least.
We have a call now from somebody who wants to talk about a little bit more about the environment. Chuck, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Ken, for being on the program. I have your bird book and really enjoy it. Would you talk to us a little about the continuing problem with the use of pesticides, pre-emergent things in agriculture, as well as lawn care products and things like that. And I will hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck.
Oh, okay. Well, I can talk about that a little bit. I'm not an expert on the chemical side of this. There are some pesticides that cause really serious problems because they're so persistent. I mean, DDT was an example of that. It breaks down so slowly that, you know, after you kill the insect with the DDT, it's still the poison persists, and whatever eats the dead insect is poisoned as well, and it passes up the food chain. And that was one of the reasons why the bald eagle was in such serious trouble back in the 1970s. And peregrine falcon and osprey and brown pelican and a whole series of other birds, especially birds that eat fish or eat other birds, their populations were plummeting until about the time the use of DDT was outlawed in the U.S. And after it was outlawed, those declines flattened out and all those birds started to increase again. So, you know, it's hard to prove cause and effect, but all of those birds came back after we stopped using DDT in this country. So something like that that's really persistent poses a problem. Other kinds of chemicals, I think any kind of, you know, herbicide or pesticide that's used should be tested really thoroughly before it's just sort of spilled out there into the environment. Things we use on our lawns that then get washed out into the rivers and lakes. You know, we always have to pay attention to that. I mean, I'm not against the use of all those chemicals. I mean, I eat food too, and it comes from farms, and there's some chemicals you have to use. But, you know, we obviously need to test thoroughly and know what those things are doing.
Okay, we have another call. Sarah?
Yes.
You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Ken. I have a number of your books, and I've been birding for a number of years. And about a week ago, I stepped out on my deck, and I heard a bird, and I knew immediately that it was not a bird that I was familiar with. So I ran and I got my binoculars, and what I saw was a white-winged tern. And I just wondered how unusual that was to be in Columbus and where it might be going.
Wow. Well, it's extremely unusual in actually anywhere in North America. I've only seen a handful of them on this continent. So that would be a great sighting. What was it doing?
Well, I looked in a number of the books, and I actually saw that it passes through Ohio occasionally through the Midwest. It definitely had a black body and the white wings, and it was just passing through. I saw it against some dark trees. So I was just amazed at this black body and these white wings. And so I just Googled it initially, and then I did look it up in a couple of the field guides. And I thought, according to the maps that I saw, that it is up occasionally in the Cleveland area, maybe?
Well, there have been records various places around the Great Lakes. It's just, you know, in the average year, there aren't any found at all. So that's really a rare sighting. So congratulations on that. If you happen to see it again, it would be great to try to get a photograph of it. I mean, I realize they're tough to photograph in flight, but...
Yeah, and the sound, because, again, according to the guides that I've looked at, the sound, the one note that it made, exactly as it's identified in the field guides, I thought that's definitely the bird I saw. So I was just amazed, but I just wondered if you had anything to say about that.
it proves that, you know, birds have wings, as Roger Torrey Peterson used to say, and birds, they can show up just about any place. So that's a great sighting.
Well, it was a striking bird to see. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Sarah.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. If you'd like to call and talk with Ken, give us a dial 614-292-8513, or you can push those buttons too, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You moved to Ohio recently. Has it been the last year or so, Ken?
It was about 5 years ago.
Okay, well, I'm a little behind the times.
I'm slow at doing things, so it took me... it took me like 9 months to actually go through the process of moving.
You came here from, you moved here from Arizona. Obviously, you travel all over the world for your job, but you were living in Arizona for a number of years.
That's right.
Is everything absolutely totally different about birding between Arizona and Ohio?
Most things are different. Arizona is good. It has a lot of specialty birds that people go there to see, and they say, oh, wow, you know, it's great birding here. But after you've lived there for a few years, those things are not, they're not novel anymore. And for migration, this is a much better area.
Why is that?
There are so many birds that pass through here. In Arizona, there are a lot of birds around, but the migration isn't so visible. Things sort of drift in and out. And I'm up on the close to the Lake Erie shoreline in northern Ohio, and it's spectacular for the numbers of migrant birds we get in spring and fall.
Has anything surprised you about Ohio since you moved here?
As
far as birding goes, besides heaven knows what.
I'm just trying to think, has anything not surprised me about Ohio? It's one thing I'm really impressed to see, there are so many active and expert birders in the state, at all different levels of expertise, from ornithologists who are known worldwide to people who just enjoy the birds in their backyards. But they all seem to get along really well.
Why do you think there are so many people that enjoy birding in Ohio? Any sense about that yet?
Well, it may be partly the fact that there are so many birds, and so it's hard to avoid noticing them. And also, there's a long history of birding here. Some of the very first real experts on bird watching, on going out and finding birds with binoculars instead of a shotgun, were here in Ohio. So we've got this great history and tradition.
We've got a call now. Tracy, you're on the air.
Good morning, Ken.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question on bird feeding. I'm not a bird expert by any means, but I do enjoy feeding the birds. And one thing is I've noticed they have been eating ferociously lately. I don't know why, but my question is, should we be feeding birds? And if we should or shouldn't, are there things that we should think that we should do and things that we definitely should not do?
Okay. Yeah, well, I've got strong opinions about that, too. Bird feeding, I think, is a worthwhile thing to do, and we do it more for us than for them. The birds are pretty well capable of taking care of themselves and finding food for themselves almost all the time. There's the occasional, if there's an ice storm and everything is just coated with thick ice, then the birds may be genuinely in trouble and need to be fed. But most of the time, if we put out bird feeders, it's for our own enjoyment and education. And I think that's a very worthwhile reason to do it. We've got bird feeders out at the house, and I favor the idea of sort of feeding in moderation and not putting out huge amounts of food. Put enough out there every day to bring the birds back. And you'll get to see them, and then if they deplete the bird feeder before the day's over, they can go find something else to eat.
A lot of folks are just naturalizing their yards now, right, Ken, to attract the same birds, or maybe even a wider variety.
That's right. You can actually attract more different kinds by planting certain things, especially native plants. I'm a big proponent of the idea of using native plants in landscaping. And that will attract a wide variety. Putting out water for birds is a great way to attract all kinds of things, little warblers and flycatchers and other insect-eating birds that won't go for birdseed.
There was a bird bath at a garage sale a couple of weeks ago, and I snagged that baby. I couldn't believe anyone would sell a bird bath. I mean, you could always use a bird bath.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You just fill it with water and plop it out in your backyard. We have an email from Hal. He says, where there used to be many songbirds in my central Ohio backyard, crows and sparrows prevail. Robins don't even have worms to eat from chemically controlled lawns like that in my condo. Are we driving off diversity in our own backyards?
The answer would be yes in some places. I mean, it's possible to have a neighborhood that's just so manicured and, where it's reduced to nothing but green lawns and concrete. It's not going to support very many birds. That is a concern. There are places where birds like house sparrows and American crows have become so common that they do actually depress the populations of other birds.
How do they do that?
Well, house sparrows are just so successful that they can live on anything. They've been adapting to living with humans for 3,000 years. And house sparrows they'll take all the good nesting sites. They'll find all the food. Crows will actually eat the eggs and young of other birds. And so if there's an abundance of them, it's a problem.
I figured crows just drive you off from the noise.
Well,
what is
too,
the deal
yeah.
with them in the morning when they sit up in a tree, a bunch of them, and squawk at each other? Why are they doing that?
Well, they're very social birds. They're very intelligent. They're a lot like humans.
One morning I was at the river and I saw a crow at the very top of a tree, and I had a little puppy who was playing around and goofing around, so I just stood there and watched. And over the course of about a half hour, probably 30 or 40 more crows came in from all directions and joined that crow. I think it was a crow, but it was a big black bird at the top of this tree, and they joined him from all directions they came. It was like he was calling, calling school to order or something.
Yeah, well, they do that, not necessarily for school, but they're so social. You'll occasionally see just a lone crow by itself, but for much of the year they're in flocks.
Do most birds travel in very large flocks, or does it vary widely?
It varies a lot depending on the species. A lot, probably there is many that are solitary as there are birds that travel in flocks. And sort of a typical thing that you'll see, especially during migration seasons in winter, is that you'll find these mixed flocks where it's only a few of each kind, but they're actually traveling together. So you'll see chickadees, there may be five or six chickadees and a couple of downy woodpeckers and a couple of white-breasted nuthatches and three or four brown creepers and a ruby-crowned kinglet. And they're not related, but they're all traveling around together. Partly being in a flock like that, they can spot predators more easily.
What is a common Ohio bird that travels in onesies and twosies?
Well, depending on the season, a lot of these birds are going to be just in pairs or singles. During the nesting season.
Okay.
A lot of the birds that stick around through the winter do gather into flocks. Song sparrow would be a good example of, even where there are a lot of song sparrows around, they're not in well-organized flocks. They tend to be just sort of independent and going their own way.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org with questions or comments. For Ken Kaufman, this is WOSU 820 NPR News. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
I listen to NPR every day. It gives us insight into why people do what they do and have a passion for it. We hear from people in their words, and it's not the reporters telling us what this and that person said, whether it's about the economy in the United States or the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm Bethany Donnell, and WOSU is my source for in-depth reporting in a soundbite age.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Coming up next hour, author and journalist Colin Bevan talks about his year-long project in which he, his wife, his two-year-old daughter, and his four-year-old dog attempted to live in the middle of New York City with as little environmental impact as possible. Stay tuned for that conversation coming up in just about 20 minutes. It's a nice day today, even for some birding. Currently, it's 72 and sunny. A mix of sun and clouds today, high around 83 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight with a low around 61. Tomorrow should be a bit more mild, high around 78. Mostly cloudy skies early, and then partly cloudy skies in the afternoon.
Support for WOSU comes from Integrate, helping to improve business performance through brand design and marketing communications for more than 20 years. On the web at integrateinc.com or at 614-421-0004.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with famed birder Ken Kaufman, author of Lives of North American Birds and Kingbird Highway, among many others. We have some phone calls right away, Ken. Let's get to them. I know people are very, very curious about this issue. Karen, you're on the air. Karen?
Oh, hello. I'm sorry. I didn't hear my name. We had kind of a sad happening on our front porch. Two or three weeks ago, we found a very small gray bird. Apparently, had flown into the window. And I tried to identify him. The only thing I could come up with was a catbird. But this bird was much smaller than 9 inches. It had no black cap, and it had no reddish-brown patch under its tail. I wondered if you had any idea if it could be other than a catbird that I just didn't identify correctly.
What do you think, Ken?
Well, it's challenging, and actually, sometimes it's harder to, when you see a dead bird, it's not as immediately apparent what it is as when you see it alive, when it's got all the behavior and so on that,
right.
It acts like a catbird, that sort of thing. This time of year, you've got young birds of various species that a lot of them are relatively plain and don't have the bright colors of the adults, and they're also not very experienced, and so they may be more likely to do something like flying into a window.
Okay.
So it could be a challenge.
Yeah, I have heard a catbird in our area, so I wondered if it was juvenile.
What does a catbird sound like?
Like a cat.
I wondered. I thought, oh, there's a catbird, too, that's not just some mythological bird like a unicorn or something. Okay.
Yeah, it sounds like a cat meowing. Yeah.
Thank
well,
you, Karen.
Thanks for your help. Bye-bye.
Bye. And David, you're on the air.
Hi. I've got a question about the crows you were speaking of earlier. I'm somewhat new to birding, but I have been paying much more attention. And the crows in my Worthington neighborhood all but enforce a no-fly zone with the hawks. And I've even seen them drive an owl off. And I understand why they're driving off the hawks and the owls. But why can't the hawks and the owls fight back?
Well,
the little wusses.
it's really, it's interesting behavior to watch. I mean, I can remember the first time I ever saw a great horned owl when I was a little kid. It was being chased by crows, and I thought, well, that's interesting. I think the crows are smart, and they're very agile. They're very adept at harassing the larger birds without getting caught. And occasionally they'll make a mistake, and you will see a situation where a hawk actually catches a crow. And it's like, oops, that didn't work out so well. But so often they'll just sort of hang back just far enough that they won't get caught. And they're so irritating that it's easier for a hawk or an owl just to move on to another spot.
Okay, Michael, you're on the air. You want to talk about hummingbirds.
Yes, I have a couple comments to make. I've been enjoying birds for many years, and I was lucky enough to be given some old Audubon prints by my great-grandfather, and obviously I cherish those. But anyway, and I've actually even seen red-winged blackbirds display that same behavior as crows and chase even crows around to keep them away from the nesting points and that type of thing. But my main question is, I have been lucky enough to sort of gather a community of hummingbirds over the years. Why I say that is, I grow a plant known as Tithonia, or sometimes commonly known as Mexican sunflower, and I know that's not native to the region, but they are like a magnet for hummingbirds. My question is this: when is the migration for hummingbirds as to when they go south? Because I'm seeing less of them, obviously, but yesterday I saw two or three more, and I just wonder when is the cutoff point?
Well, there isn't a sharp cutoff point because they sort of straggle out. There are a lot of them on their way south now, and if we were like on the central coast of Texas, there are a lot of the ruby-throated hummingbirds from all over the east that go south toward the Gulf Coast and then sort of go around through Texas and eastern Mexico on their way south, and it's the peak of the migration right about now. But there will be some stragglers around here at least into October.
Okay, that was my question, because like I say, there were quite a few, and then you they kind of like go away, and then I saw three yesterday, and I think, well, I wonder if you guys need to get going. And I quit putting out the nectar, and I make my own nectar. I don't use the chemical the red stuff, and I try to be green on that, if that's a good word for it. But they're amazing, amazing creatures.
They sure are. I agree.
I've got quite a few. I think at least three different varieties that I can identify. But and they can get feisty too. As far as
they don't scare me.
Have one fly close to your head sometimes. It's like, wow, they are speed demons, that's for sure. Okay, thank you very much for your time and good luck to you.
Thanks for your call. If you would like to give us a call and with the remarks or questions, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email now from Abby. She says, I have seen several house finches at my feeder with conjunctivitis. I understand it is highly contagious to other house finches. Is it always fatal? Should I discontinue feeding them as not to spread the disease? What do you think, Ken?
It's usually fatal. And if there are a lot of birds around that have it, it's probably a good idea to discontinue feeding for a while because, give the birds a chance to disperse so that you don't have a concentration of them coming in. It's an unfortunate thing, but there's not a lot that we can do about it.
What conjunctivitis, is this like in the eyes? Is this
That's right, yeah, so a disease around the eyes.
Why does it kill them?
Probably mostly just the fact that they're not able to see predators coming. They're not able to feed as effectively.
Okay.
I don't know if it's directly fatal or if it's just the side effects.
Okay, we have another question about bird baths. Leonora.
I feed the birds in my neighborhood, and apparently I'm the only one for miles around because I have a lot, and they do use my bird bath a lot. However, I have a heater for my bird bath, and someone told me that when it's very, very cold, they will get in the bird bath and swish around, and then once they start to fly, they'll freeze to death. I just wondered if this was an urban tale or I could use my heater for my bird bath.
Yeah, you're right. That is an urban legend, or maybe a suburban legend. But they're they've got a certain amount of survival instinct and intelligence, and they won't get in and splash around in the water when it's extremely cold weather. So it's a good idea actually to have that heater out there to keep the water open for the birds.
Okay, Angela, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
Hello?
Angela?
Yes.
You're on the air.
I have a question.
Okay.
Yes, I can hear now. Hi.
Hi.
I have a very large silver lace vine, which is it's attracting a lot of sparrows. There are tons of sparrows nesting in this vine, and in fact, every evening when they come back, it's a huge raucous noise as they try to settle into their nest. But I wondered how I can attract other birds.
To the same vine?
To my yard. It seems like we're just completely overtaken by sparrows all the time.
Okay.
Unfortunately, when the sparrows decide to use one of those big vines as a roosting site, there aren't too many gentle things you can do to discourage them. But if you, there are a variety of things you can plant. I mean, right now, we're sort of heading into the fall season. But if you had, a variety of native evergreens, something like Eastern Red Cedar is a great plant. It's got good cover for native birds. It's got berries that some birds will eat. Planting a diversity of things is a good way to attract a variety of birds. If you put out a lot of bird seed, you'll probably just attract the sparrows to come down from the vine and eat the bird seed, so that probably won't help any.
It's right around this time of year, as I'm walking through the woods or the grassy natural native grass areas, I just grab seeds off a few of the flowers that are browning, and I bring them back to my backyard and just toss them in there and hope for the best.
Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, a native wildflower garden, as long as you can convince the neighbors that it's not just a patch of weeds, it's a great thing to have.
Well, we just don't let them in our backyard if they say that. Okay. Joyce, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, Joyce, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Every night I go down to the lake,
and I'm watching red-winged blackbird. Well, I'm watching the otter, but at the same time, a blue heron flies across the lake, and the red-winged blackbird's mobbing. It happens every night, but they don't mob the Canada geese.
It's like a rumble.
Okay. Why don't they bother the geese?
Well, red-winged blackbirds—they've got a little bit too much energy, and the males. But you know, it's usually the boys that cause all the trouble. And so the male red-winged blackbirds just like to harass larger birds. In the case of the great blue heron, great blues—they'll occasionally catch other birds. They don't just necessarily eat fish. They'll occasionally catch other birds, and so there may be some sort of awareness of that on the part of the blackbirds. Whereas Canada geese, you know, they may be just as big and obnoxious, but they don't eat other birds.
When I first moved to Ohio from Michigan, and I saw, it was either an egret or a heron, I can't remember now, but it was something like that in just a little stream. It was up by Lake Erie. I thought they must be horribly lost. I thought it was the most exotic thing I'd ever seen, and it turns out they're all over the place. They're down by the river where I live, and I love it. It's one of the most wonderful things about Ohio, I think.
Yeah, isn't it great? I mean, there's so many birds around here. I love living here because I get to see things like bald eagles and egrets and herons and geese. I mean, I still like Canada geese, you know, even though there are a lot of them around. It's just it's such a birdie state all over the state and all year.
It's not just about Buckeyes. There's birds, too. We have an email from a listener. I saw a Wilson's warbler a few weeks ago. He said, whoever he or she said, they confirmed this via online photo and audio of its song. How lost was this little guy? So I guess a Wilson's warbler isn't typically around Central Ohio. How lost was he, Ken?
Not lost at all, as long as it was after about the middle of August. They don't nest around here. They nest farther north and farther west, and they winter mostly in Mexico and Central America. But in migration, we do get good numbers of Wilson's warblers passing through the state. I actually saw a couple yesterday. So that's one of the things we love about the migration season. We get all these birds passing through that aren't here in the summer or winter.
What should we be looking for right now in Central Ohio, or does it differ much from where you're at up in Cleveland?
It's pretty much the same kinds of things. One of the things that the active bird watchers like to look for right now is the warblers. And the warblers are very small birds, but there are quite a few different kinds. They're very colorful. You find them in any kind of area with lots of trees and bushes. So there are a lot of the parks right around Columbus that are very good. Blendon Woods is one of my favorite parks. Greenlawn Cemetery there in the city is a long-term famous spot to look for warblers.
Cemeteries apparently are very popular with birds.
That's right. Well, a lot of them are very attractively planted, and they have a good variety of trees and shrubs, and it's easy to to walk around on the roadways and look for birds.
Are the number of species limited by population necessarily? We may have different kinds of species, but when you're in town and there's a lot of people around, are we limited very much, or is it more than we think?
There tend to be fewer kinds of birds in the middle of the city than there are out in wilder country, but if you look closely at any backyard, you know, even a small backyard in town, and watch over a period of time, you'd be surprised at how many different birds stop through. It's not unusual to, for someone who keeps a yard list to come up with 50 or 60 species, even in a small suburban yard.
Okay. We have Barb, you're on the line.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I have a lot of flowers in my yard, and I have a lot of butterflies and bees, but I haven't had any luck in attracting birds, even though I do have a lot of native flowers with seed heads and grasses. Do you have any ideas? Oh, and I have a bird bath, too, that they pretty much ignore.
Well, it may just be bad attitude on the part of the birds, but if you've got things in the composite family, daisy family, that that will go to seed, they should eventually attract things like goldfinches. And have you put in any kind of hummingbird flowers, like red tubular flowers?
Yeah, I do see a couple hummingbirds, but really not very many. I see some occasionally in, like trumpet vine. And.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it sounds like you've got the right kinds of plants, and it may just be a matter of being, you know, patient and waiting, or if you add a few shrubs that provide cover. Sometimes if a garden is just very open, the birds won't come in because there's no easy cover for them to get too nearby.
Okay, we have an email from Charlotte. She says, I read that birds tend to be attracted to bright red berries during their migrations rather than dark berries. I need to choose between a small snowball viburnum and a lacecap viburnum for the backyard. Do you recommend one more than the other for the birds?
That's a good question. I don't. I'm not familiar with those two viburnums, but for birds that are just passing through, they may be more likely to notice the more brightly colored berries. But it's true that a lot of migrant birds will stop in to eat berries. You can attract thrushes and waxwings and even vireos to berries like that.
I read a little something the other day about research that's being done to show how different birds are from each other, not just species, but within a species, how they have different markings and different personalities and different facial expressions, if that's a word that can be applied to a bird. And they showed four different pictures of, I think they were blackbirds or crows, and indeed they were very different. I don't know if one was older than the other, if it was age-related, but is that what you found, Ken?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they have different personalities and different markings, and really no two individual birds look exactly the same. If you start trying to do illustrations of birds, you realize you have to sort of average it out, because it's like with humans, there are no two individuals that are really identical. And that's part of what keeps it interesting.
Yeah, just like people.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, we have more callers, we have more emailers, and we don't have enough time. So, Ken, I hope you'll join us again sometime soon.
Well, thanks very much, Ann. I've enjoyed talking with you.
You have been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I was joined today by famed birder Ken Kaufman, author of Lives of North American Birds and many, many other books that I hope we'll talk about again later. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD H20 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support WOSU Public Media by becoming a volunteer today. WOSU is currently looking for a daytime volunteer to assist with the administration of the volunteer program. You must be computer proficient and may go through an application and interview process. For more information on this and other volunteer opportunities, visit us online at wosu.org/volunteers. And thanks for supporting WOSU.
On the next Fresh Air, a year after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, which marked the beginning of the global economic crisis, we consider how the financial industry has changed and not changed. We talk with New York Times financial reporter and columnist Gretchen Morgenson. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is coming up today at noon on WOSU 820 NPR News. It's warming up today. Currently, it's 73 degrees and sunny. Expected high should be somewhere around 83 degrees. Partly cloudy skies tonight with a low around 61. Get more radio. Shorten WOSU's on-air pledge drive by making your pledge now. Help us reach the $20,000 goal by October 14th, and we'll have a pledge-free day in our drive. Give now online at wosu.org/pledge-free.
Hello, I'm Ann Fisher. A lot of people out there talk about how they're going to go off the grid and live without environmental impact, but few do. Colin Bevan and his family did for a year. They bought nothing, wasted nothing, they even gave up coffee, all while living with a young child in a ninth floor Manhattan apartment. A documentary of their experience, which also introduces us to Bevan's wife, Michelle Conlon, and their young daughter, has earned kudos as well. We'll talk to Colin Bevan about their one-year adventure, what they learned about saving the Earth, and how they survived themselves. Join us for that and more on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.